You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenelon.
Welcome to part two of our series on the 2019 BBC Wreath Lectures. In part one, we heard from a panel from the annual summer conference hosted by the Constitutional and Administrative Law Bar Association. The panel responded to arguments raised by Lord Sumption in his Wreath Lectures, with many thanks again to the Chair and Committee of ALBA. We will now hear Lord Sumption's response to the panel in interview with Lord Justice Singh, who opens up the conversation.
I've learnt during the course of today that in 1951, Lord Redcliffe gave the Wreath Lectures on the subject of power and the state. Subsequently, I've also learned that in 1980, Professor Sir Ian Kennedy, a very eminent legal academic, gave the Wreath Lectures on the subject of the unmasking of medicine. The recent Wreath Lectures, I think we can all agree, have not only been erudite and eloquent, but have contributed enormously to the public understanding of law and its place in our society more generally. I'm sure we all can think of friends who've approached us and said that they're not lawyers at all and perhaps previously had no interest in the law, but they have found the Wreath Lectures extremely stimulating. Jonathan, can I start in trying to draw out some of the strands, perhaps, which we've heard in the earlier panel discussion today by asking you about judicial review? Some people might be left with the impression from your lectures that somehow judicial review might be thought to be illegitimate in a democratic society. I don't think that's actually your view, is it?
No, it's not my view. Judicial review has an absolutely fundamental role in restraining excesses of power and abuses of power by the executive. And for that reason, much of what Charlie Faulkner said this morning, I wouldn't dissent from for a moment, nor would I dissent from the proposition that it is very difficult to draw the line between what is a question of policy that properly belongs to the realm of politics and what is a question of law that properly belongs to the courts. But it seems to me that the fact that it is difficult to draw a line does not mean to say that such a line doesn't exist, and we cannot construct our collective arrangements on the footing that everything must be capable of a litmus paper test. I think that there is, to take just one obvious area, a very clear difference, which is challenged by the Human Rights Act and the Convention, between the question what the law is and the question what it ought to be. I do not regard the latter as being a proper question for courts.
I'll come back, if I may, to consider the Human Rights Act more specifically later. But can I just stay with judicial review in, as it were, purely domestic law terms for now? One of the points I think that Lord Dyson made was that in the vast majority of judicial review cases, what is in issue is not the acts of the legislature at all, it's the acts of the executive. And, of course, up and down the country, there will be local authorities as well as central government departments which are making many decisions, no doubt important to those affected, but in one sense, relatively commonplace and routine decisions, which may be the subject of judicial review. There's nothing wrong, is there, with the grounds of judicial review that the courts have developed over the last 50 or so years?
There's nothing wrong with the grounds in themselves, leaving aside the Human Rights Act, which you're coming to.
Yes.
That's certainly right. But they are designed to be, quite rightly, flexible tests, and how far you push a flexible test is very much a question of judicial priorities and judicial instincts. I think that over the last 20 or 30 years, the limits have been pushed out too far. But I do accept that judicial attitudes are not monolithic, and that they are not inflexible over time. And I think that there is some evidence that the up-and-coming generation of judges are more circumspect in their regard for what is properly part of the political domain than their predecessors were. And in fact, I also think that there are some indications to that effect at Strasbourg. Somebody said in the panel discussion that we've just had, I forget who it was, that Strasbourg has recently enlarged the scope of the margin of appreciation. Mm. And I think that there is a fair amount of evidence that that is so. I hope that that trend continues, because it would relieve, not totally, but to some extent, some of my concerns about the direction in which we have been heading before.
Yes. When one thinks about the development of the grounds of judicial review, at least theoretically, they were said, and perhaps still are said, to be rooted in the doctrine of ultra vires. In other words, that ultimately, a question of public law is usually going to be one of statutory construction, construing the statute which confers powers on the executive body in question. But we all know that in that context, the courts have developed a number of doctrines, such as the concept of a substantive legitimate expectation. As it were, these are implied limitations on statutory powers. The question I wanted to ask you is this. Would you agree that Parliament seems to be relatively content with the courts to have engaged in that development of, in effect, common law principles, just as they have done in private law, as they've developed concepts like the law of negligence? And if Parliament fundamentally disagreed with the degree of judicial review that is taking place, of course it would be open to Parliament to reverse these trends. I mean, in some countries they do have, I think, a statute which sets out the grounds of judicial review, but our Parliament has so far chosen not to do that.
Well, it's true that many of the classic formulations of the basis of judicial review do focus on ultra vires, but as I think all of us would recognise, this is actually a bit of a cheat. Some of it is ultra vires in the proper sense of the word. The power just does not exist. Some of it is simply adding a spurious label to what is actually a complaint that the power does exist but has been exercised in an abusive or otherwise unsatisfactory way. Now, is Parliament content with this state of affairs? I don't think Parliament has a single view or a consistent view about this. Mm. I wouldn't accept that Parliament is content with the current state of affairs, at least not consistently, but I'm not sure that it's sensible to ask whether Parliament is content with it. The British Constitution, for all its vagueness, is the property of all of us, and we are entitled to be concerned about something, even if we find that Parliament is not concerned about it. What is more, I do not think that it is a very powerful argument in favour of a proposition that Parliament can cancel it out.
Can I turn to the Human Rights Act and the underlying European Convention to which it gives greater effect in domestic law? First, the scheme of the Human Rights Act itself. This can raise issues about the compatibility of primary legislation with the convention rights. They're relatively rare in practice, but I think there have been some 20 or so declarations of incompatibility since the Act came into force at the beginning of this century. I think Lord Faulkner made the point in the earlier session that a very delicate balance was struck when Parliament decided on the form of the Human Rights Act. Quite deliberately, it was decided that the courts in this country would not be given the power to strike down or set aside primary legislation, but that they would be given, at least the higher courts, would be given the power to make a declaration of incompatibility, which of course is not binding on anyone, neither the parties nor on Parliament itself. What's your response to the fact that that's a perfectly legitimate balance which has been struck in a democratic society?
Well, my concern about the Human Rights Act, and I agree that Parliament either did or should have done this with its eyes open, is that I think that there is a problem about passing an essentially legislative power to a body that stands outside the constitutional framework of the United Kingdom and is therefore not amenable to any kind of democratic input. That is the point that I was seeking to make.
That's the Strasbourg Court.
That's the Strasbourg Court. Now, some of those considerations would also apply to the institutions of the European Union. But the position is completely different in the case of the European Union. Essentially, the European Union is a process of pooling sovereignty, which does have the effect of removing decision-making to a higher level and a more remote level, but it is nevertheless a collective process in which there is input. People may differ about how valuable the European Parliament is for that purpose, but there is input from each of the member countries. It's not conceptually that different from the basis on which the 13 provinces of the United States came together to form the United States in 1787. But the creation of a judicially enforced code of law, which is what the Human Rights Convention is, which is applied in a creative and developing fashion by a court which, as a court, is not amenable to any kind of democratic input, I think creates altogether more fundamental problems.
If I can turn then more specifically to some of what you said in your lecture.
So can I just answer the point that you made about Parliament was not... I think somebody said this just in the previous panel that Parliament is not bound by... The courts aren't bound by Strasbourg, and Parliament doesn't have to comply with the invitation to amend the law.
Under Section 4 of the Human Rights Act, undoubtedly, the Act itself spells out that the Declaration of Incompatibility is not binding.
It's not binding.
I think you would be certainly entitled to make the point that as a matter of international treaty law, the judgments of the Court of Human Rights are binding.
That's exactly right. I mean, of course, Article 46 only in terms makes them binding in the case of judgments against the United Kingdom itself.
Yes.
But that is itself a bit of a cop-out to rely on that, since what would be the point in a relevantly comparable case in our deciding things in a way different from a decision made directed against France, only for it to go to Strasbourg and come back with exactly the same answer? In practice, if we accept that Parliament is at liberty to, and that you can justify the scheme by saying that Parliament can always ignore the obligations under the treaty, well, on that footing, you might as well not be party to it.
No, there can be no doubt, it seems to me, that the Human Rights Convention, like other similar treaties around the world, was intended to and does impose limitations, at least at the level of international law, on even the powers of democratic legislatures.
Yes. Right,
it's intended to do that. No doubt people would say that that's because it arose from the ashes of European conflict in the 1930s and 40s, and in particular the experience of the Holocaust, and that it is necessary, many people would say, for there to be some limits even on the powers of a democratic parliament to persecute a minority.
Well, I wouldn't differ from that in principle at all. It is, you're absolutely right to say that the convention is designed to limit the powers of domestic legislatures. And your point about the aftermath of the Second World War is also obviously well taken. The convention was designed to deal with horrors. What it has turned into is a template for most aspects of public decision making. And that is a process which, precisely because it is achieved judicially and not legislatively, crosses, to my mind, the bounds of legitimacy.
Yes. Can I turn to that aspect of your lectures specifically now and ask you about something which, in fact, I think Lady Arden, our keynote speaker, mentioned in her lecture at the start of today. She referred to the living instrument doctrine, which is the term that the Strasbourg Court has tended to use, and she suggested that it's similar to the concept of the living tree, which one can see, for example, in the jurisprudence
in the
Attorney General of Canada and Edwards in 1929. Many people would say that what has happened in the Strasbourg jurisprudence is desirable. For example, the extension of the rights in Article 14 against discrimination to gay people, to transgender people, minorities who were historically the subject of discrimination throughout Europe. At the time the convention was drafted in 1950, undoubtedly so. So if we didn't have the living instrument doctrine, what would happen to the ability of the court to protect those minorities?
We ought to be concerned about how we make law and not just about what the result of it, the process, is. Now, living tree or living instrument is an extremely vague phrase which can be used to justify anything from the simple application of general principles to specific facts to a process of creative lawmaking of the kind which the Strasbourg court and to some extent the domestic courts have engaged in under the Human Rights Convention. Now, I do not think that you can justify this simply by saying that there are many examples of rules which have arisen from this process which are desirable. I agree that there are many which are desirable, though they can, of course, also be achieved by domestic legislation. But as a general proposition, to say this may be an undemocratic way of making law, but the results are fine by me, is essentially to say that the ends justify the means. And that is actually the argument which every autocratic regime in history has used. The other problem about this is that one says the results are desirable, and I agree that many of them are, including the examples that you have taken. But there may be issues on which people disagree, and we have to have a way of resolving that disagreement. I mean, let's take one classic and increasingly significant area where the Human Rights Convention has impinged on our domestic arrangements, the right of privacy. The right of privacy is qualified by reference to the usual potential alternative policy considerations, and it's a matter for the courts under the current regime to decide where the balance lies. Now, if you can accept that a right of privacy is a valuable thing, you can accept that such matters as the prevention of crime are also valuable. How much privacy are we as a society prepared to sacrifice in order to be better protected against crime? Now, that is a question which seems to me to be inherently a matter for collective decision among us. If I say to you, privacy of my internet communications should be absolute, and you say to me, well, not if there's a risk that you may be using your Facebook account to promote terrorism or violent demonstrations or whatever, how are we to decide where the balance lies? This is such a vital matter of collective interest and so much inherently a matter of collective decision that I cannot see that the judicial determination of where the balance lies can possibly be a legitimate exercise.
Well, what I was going to say is simply two things. One, so far as the domestic court is concerned, although it is a form of constitutional review because it concerns an assessment of the compatibility of primary legislation with the convention rights, as I've said earlier, the scheme of the Human Rights Act is very clear. That function is entrusted to the courts of this country, but the courts of this country cannot require Parliament to take a different view. They can't strike down that Act of Parliament. But secondly, when it goes to Strasbourg, if such a case does go to Strasbourg, and we heard earlier today Lady Arden mentioned the Big Brother Watch case, which is going to, I think it's been heard now in the Grand Chamber, so judgment is awaited. And you're quite right, of course, and I mentioned this earlier, that as a matter of international treaty law, whatever the judgment of the court is in Strasbourg, that is binding on this country, so long as it remains a member of the Council of Europe. So that in one sense, that does have a greater effect than a declaration of incompatibility does under domestic law. But they still operate the doctrine of the margin of appreciation, just as our own court. They've been expressed in various ways, a margin of judgment, a discretionary area of judgment. Due respect or appropriate weight should be given to the judgment of the executive and the legislature. Do you really think that the courts, either here or in Strasbourg, are not sensitive to precisely the kinds of issues you've mentioned?
I think that over the history of the Strasbourg court, it has varied in the degree of sensitivity that it has to this. And as I said a few minutes ago, there are indications that at the moment the trend is in favour of rather greater circumspection. Over the whole period during which the Strasbourg court has been active, I think that the margin of appreciation that it has conceded to democratic legislatures and also to executives responsible to democratic legislatures, harking back to your original question about acts of the executive, has been far, far too narrow. I think that the notion that what the protection of rights requires in a country with a stable and long-standing constitutional tradition such as this one, and what it requires in a country which has recently escaped from 50 years of tyranny, I'm thinking of most of the Eastern European countries, is simply not the same. And if only for that reason, the margin of appreciation should always have been very much higher. And one area where the Strasbourg court has always been fairly circumspect is issues where people's feelings essentially depend on the strength of their religious allegiance, which is why in one of its more incoherent decisions, the decision on abortion in the Irish A, B and C case, it basically steered clear of the issue of principle and decided it upon a consideration that most people would feel was trivial by comparison with the moral issue at the heart of the abortion debate. So, you know, there are some issues on which it's always been circumspect. But in dealing with areas where the strength of feeling is not based on religious allegiance, but on essentially on political judgment, it has been a great deal less sensitive. That may change, I hope so.
Can I turn to a slightly different topic? But many of us found, if I may say so, your, I think it was the fourth lecture which you delivered in Washington about American constitutional experience, very interesting. And there were two points particularly, I think, that were touched on by earlier speakers in the panel, which I wanted to mention again. The first was what you said in your lecture about cases like Lochner versus New York in the early part of the 20th century. And just to remind people that there was, for about 30 or 35 years in the early part of the 20th century, a lot of experience of the US Supreme Court striking down what many people regarded as progressive legislation to protect workers, children in factories and things of that sort. And that tended to get struck down by the American Supreme Court as being an unconstitutional interference with freedom of contract, which they implied into the Constitution through the Due Process Clause.
Well, they said it was part of liberty.
Exactly. It was the Liberty Clause of the 14th and the 5th Amendments. Does that example illustrate to your mind that there can be dangers in assessing the propriety or the legitimacy of what courts are doing by reference to the outcomes? In other words, that liberals used to disapprove of the Supreme Court and now they tend to approve of it.
I think it illustrates it very well, which is, I think, the point I was seeking to make in the fourth lecture. We cannot assume that courts will always agree with our particular outlook. We cannot assume that they will always be consistent. I mean, I think there are two problems worth mentioning. One is that you take a general concept like liberty, which is at the heart of the 14th Amendment, and you therefore hand over to judges the decision what the limits of liberty are. Nobody suggests that liberty must mean you can do whatever you like. One view is the classic Mill view, that you can do whatever you like except where it interferes with other people. Moral issues like abortion are extremely difficult to fit within either of those schemes. So essentially, the breadth of the concept virtually invites the court to produce a legislative solution which will differ from over different periods, but with the critical difference in the United States that because it's interpreting the Constitution or purporting to do so, it is making a decision which is completely irreversible by any legislation that you can imagine, indeed completely immune from any process other than an amendment of the Constitution or a change of mind by the Supreme Court. And courts are not famous for their willingness to accept error. Brown and the Board of Education managed to create an epoch-making decision, immense social importance in the United States, without really grappling with the fact that 60 years before, their predecessors had said something completely different. The honest answer would have been, we were wrong, or we certainly were wrong as applied to current conditions. I think they should probably have said both of those things. But courts are very reluctant to do that. But the other lesson I think it's worth making from this particular aspect of the American experience is that what it tends to do is to turn elections, to some extent, into contests for the right to appoint justices to the US Supreme Court. I never realized quite how significant a factor this was until I started meeting a lot of people in the United States who said, I'm going to vote for Trump. I think he is, I won't quote the expressions then used, but they were not favorable expressions, but I want some more Republicans on the Supreme Court. The net result of that is that you get appalling scenes like those that we saw in the confirmation hearings of Justice Kavanaugh, and one does get, this is a form of political pressure on judges, which would be extremely destructive if it were ever imported here. Now, I would be passionately opposed to any suggestion that there should be political vetting of judges or confirmation hearings or anything of the sort, and recent American experience reinforces the already very strong views that I had on that point. I suspect that almost everyone in this room will agree, but I do think that the judiciary cannot have it both ways. If they wish to justify a state of affairs in which they are essentially intervening in policy considerations, as particularly under the Human Rights Act they frequently do, there is going to be irresistible pressure for such a hearing. And it's very difficult to say that if the courts have power to make political decisions, they shouldn't in some way be responsible. Now, you can try and square this circle by saying, well, they'll just have to get stuffed and do without the confirmation hearings. But frankly, I think this is a bit unrealistic. If we have courts charged with making decisions in areas which are regarded as essentially political, we are going to get pressure of this kind, and we are going to be pushed into an area which I think would be very damaging indeed.
I wonder if that is really borne out by the experience of the first 19 years of the Human Rights Act in this country. Many of those fears were undoubtedly expressed by people as the Human Rights Bill was going through Parliament more than 20 years ago. But I think Lord Faulkner was Lord Chancellor when the Constitutional Reform Act 2005 was enacted. And it might be said that if anything, what's happened since the Human Rights Act came into force in this country is that we have put in place institutional arrangements to create even greater insulation of the judiciary and their independence from the political process. I have in mind, for example, the Independent Appointments Commission rather than appointment by the Lord Chancellor, who's a member of the Cabinet. Speaking for myself, I'm not aware of any great public clamour for judges in this country to be subject to some kind of political confirmation process. And it may be that that reflects the fact that actually our judges have been conscientious, sensible, balanced in the way that they've applied the Human Rights Act.
Well, it comes and goes. There have been pressures from some parts of the press and from some parts of the House of Commons for some kind of confirmation hearing. They haven't been terribly well thought out. They haven't acquired much traction. But the pressure is there, and it is liable to grow over time. I certainly think that recent examples of what confirmation hearings can look like in the United States have deterred an awful lot of people who might otherwise have been sympathetic to such causes. But in the long term, I don't think that we can treat our judges as part of the decision-making element in the Constitution without subjecting it to the same disciplines of public responsibility as apply to other parts of the decision-making role in our Constitution.
Can I turn finally to one last topic, which was, I think, touched on particularly by Meg Russell and Vernon Bogdaner in the panel session, which is what might be called the topic of in defence of politics. What would be your answer to the question I think Meg Russell raised, or what can be done to improve things?
Yes. Well, in the lectures, I only made one suggestion. I certainly didn't suggest that it was a cure-all, and it clearly isn't. I think that one of the problems that we are suffering from is that the process of compromise within political parties, which is where the compromise process has really occurred as well as between parties, has been stymied as a result of the collapse in their membership numbers by comparison with what I suppose one should regard as the golden age in the 1950s, and by entryism of one sort or another in both major parties. Both of these developments have, I think, obstructed the ability of parties to represent a coalition of opinion within themselves, which is something that obviously makes it a great deal easier for them to achieve a coalition of opinion across the House of Commons with other parties. And we have seen a certain amount of that over the past 3 years in relation to Brexit. I think it would help, but may not cure the thing entirely, if we did have some form of proportional representation. And it might help, though I'm less certain about this, if we had some form of open primaries for party candidates. Ultimately, you cannot force political engagement. Now, somebody said, I think it was Lord Faulkner this morning, that the public are passionate about, e.g., Brexit and possibly about quite a large number of other things. And that is, I think, one of the ironic things. We have a situation in which politics at the moment is, whether one admires what's happening or not, is particularly interesting, and a lot of people are passionately interested in it. But that doesn't mean to say that they are prepared personally to engage in the actual process, e.g. by joining political parties. I am myself sceptical about citizens' assemblies. I think they can work as a consultative body. I think the process of ensuring that an assembly is indeed truly representative is more difficult than people realise, but I'd certainly be in favour of looking further into that possibility. Some form of political engagement, or greater political engagement, in the way in which our political decisions are making, rather than sitting back and criticising, however passionately, is absolutely indispensable, because the only alternative is going to be a very much more authoritarian style of politics, whichever party is in power, and I think most of us here would regret that.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma-Louise Fenelon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.